From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. A proposal in Namibia would share some of the country's diamond and uranium wealth with all Namibians.
The arguments I was encountering in Namibia were not arguments for the state to take everything over. They were arguments for directly distributing some share of the wealth that's being produced to the citizenry.
I'll talk with anthropologist James Ferguson about the social obligation of sharing on today's show. But first, Rebecca Cruz and I will discuss the return of giant lily pads that had nearly gone extinct in Paraguay, and the drought in India that is significantly affecting the supply and cost of chickpea, which has become an important global food staple.
As a food becomes popular, the distribution and the ability to get that food can become difficult.
That's all coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat. Rebecca Cruz, we're going to take a little bit of a turn today and talk about Paraguay. Let's talk about what's going on there in terms of this return of this endangered giant lily pad that's coming back in Paraguay that had been almost extinct. Tell us why this is happening, kind of where it went, why it's coming back, and what we are to think about this resurgence in the ecosphere.
Yeah, this is quite amazing. And again, go and look at the pictures. These lily pads are about the size of me, about 5 foot, if not a little bit bigger. And really, they started to disappear. And in fact, many of the locals claimed that they were extinct, that they hadn't seen them in years due to them being used for medicinal purposes, all sorts of different ailments. They could make a tea out of these lily pads and that would cure or deal with some of these ailments. On top of that, there was some dredging that took place and they just slowly disappeared. So with stopping of that, it seems that they've come back and they've actually been a huge boon for tourism as boats are rented out to go and wade and get amongst these lily pads, and people are just amazed by it. So it's really quite an interesting story to talk about.
All right, well, let's shift to India. Now, we've recently talked about massive flooding in India, Bangladesh, in the subcontinent of Asia. But today, let's talk about drought. I mean, India is a big country, and so, you know, flooding in some areas, but drought in others, definitely experiencing extreme weather. But the impact of this drought is particularly linked to chickpea. And the chickpea supply, which is a huge staple around the world, all over that part of the world, Middle East, even into Europe and in the UK, where hummus is a staple food. But the drought in India has driven down the supply of the chickpea, and therefore the price has gone significantly up. Now, I haven't bought hummus lately, so I can't really say what the cost is. But nonetheless, reminds us of this connection between weather, food, and our overall food security.
Absolutely. And it also reminds us that as these trends and as we become more globalized in our food consumption, that there are consequences to this. And it's kind of a give and take. So as there is a drought in one area, there are consequences elsewhere. Or as a food becomes popular, the distribution and the ability to get that food can become difficult. Hummus, as you mentioned, yes, it's always been a staple in the Middle East, but it's now a huge staple in places like London and this country. I'd never even heard of hummus until the 1990s. And now I feed it to my child fairly regularly. So we've come to rely on this as a staple of food. And the effects of weather are significant. And we see this in all sorts of other cases. In recent years, droughts have led to shortages, or storms as well, to shortages in vanilla, in almonds, and in chocolate even, as we are coming up on Valentine's Day. Got to think about that chocolate consumption. So these things are all connected. And it's really important to remember that it is, in many ways, a global economy. And as there is a shift or a depletion in one area, it has an effect all around the world.
Even the food on our table. All right. Thanks so much, Rebecca, as always.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter. We're at Worldviews KGOU, and I'm at Suzette Gorlat. Next, we'll talk with anthropologist James Ferguson about programs that direct small amounts of money to a large number of poor people. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. James Ferguson is an anthropologist at Stanford University and the author of the book, Give a Man a Fish, Reflections on the New Politics of Distribution. In his book, Ferguson looks at how small cash transfers to poor people can help alleviate poverty and spur economic growth. Jim Ferguson, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here, and I'm really interested in talking about the work that you're doing. You're on campus as part of a dream course, Andreana Prichard's dream course on the urge to help, and we've had some other guests, very fascinating, but I want to start with kind of your own background and how and why you started doing the work that you've been doing in Africa. Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started doing the work that you do there?
Yeah, I can. I grew up in Southern California. I had no connection with Africa. I had no special interest in it until I was at university there at the University of California, Santa Barbara. I got interested in anthropology. And it's really as a result of my interest in anthropology that I first started to read things about Africa. And it happened that the people who taught me anthropology were distinguished Africanists. And so the anthropology I learned had a lot to do with Africa. And when I decided to go to graduate school and to specialize in anthropology, then it became kind of logical that Africa would be the place I would focus on. But it's not as if I grew up dreaming of the African savannah or something. That was not my story.
But I assume that you've spent some time there since then, since you started studying it.
So, yes, that's right.
And particularly in southern
Africa, first in Lesotho, which is a small country surrounded by South Africa. And then in Zambia, those are the places I've spent the most time. For my latest project, I spent more time in South Africa and Namibia, but all in the same region.
Lesotho is a very interesting country to me. When you look at a map, that you have a small country that's totally surrounded entirely by another country.
That's very much one of the interesting things about Lesotho, because it is, in fact, functionally part of the wider regional economy. And for years and years, people basically survived by migrating out of the country and working in South Africa, particularly men working in the gold mines. So you had this peculiar situation where you have a nation state, which is internationally credentialed as a nation state, with a national economy that is mostly outside of its own borders. So that's one of the things I wrote about in my first book, was this peculiar situation of a nation state that really couldn't be described in terms of having a nation-based economic system.
And not only peculiar, but unique. Right. I mean, do we see
not
many
entirely
other cases?
Unique? Yeah. Because there's a lot of countries that are very reliant on labor migration and resources coming from outside the country. I think of some of the Caribbean states, for instance, where they depend a lot on remittances and on people sort of coming home and building houses for retirement.
That makes sense to other than the island nations, but
surrounded
by water instead of by another state. Well, let's talk about the work that you're doing, and in fact, the title of your talk here on campus. I was really intrigued by this, Presence and Social Obligation, an essay on the share. If I understand correctly, the work that you're most recently doing in your most recent book, Give a Man a Fish, Reflections on the New Politics of Distribution, focuses on the ways that presence rather than membership can serve as a basis of social obligation, including the obligation to share. And that's a wonderful description that Dr. Prichard gave to me. So tell us about that. That's such a fascinating thing. Presence rather than membership. What exactly do you mean there? And then this notion of social obligation, particularly to share with others.
Yes. Well, let me start with the share. The book is very concerned with the question of who is owed what, and in particular, where there are poor people, what kind of claims do they have, what kind of resources are shared with them. And I'm interested in the idea that payments made to poor people might be thought of as a share. Usually they've been thought of more like gifts. They've been thought of more like things like, oh, you're in need, you're impoverished, we feel sorry for you, we'll give you a little bit of money. And of course, that leaves people feeling often devalued or stigmatized or feeling like they're not able to reciprocate in some way. I'm interested in a very different way of thinking about what it means when a payment is transferred to a poor person, as increasingly is happening in many African countries. So, for instance, in Namibia, I studied a very interesting movement there, campaigning for what they call a basic income grant. And they made arguments like this. They said, Namibia is not a poor country. Namibia actually has diamonds and uranium, and there's a lot of money being made in Namibia. But most Namibians never see any of it. And they say, well, why is that? Whose diamonds are they? Whose uranium is that? Doesn't it really belong to the people of the country? And if it belongs to the people of the country, then why shouldn't we receive a share? The idea being that people should receive shares. Everybody, every single person should receive a certain amount of money, quite a small amount of money they're proposing, but a certain small amount of money every month as their share of a national wealth. Now, that sounds pretty unusual, I think, to American ears, but we have something similar in the U.S. state of Alaska, where there is a trust fund that receives a share of the oil wealth each year and then pays that oil wealth out as direct payments to the residents of Alaska. So if you're a resident of Alaska, you get a check every year, which represents your share of the oil wealth. That feels very different, it seems, than getting a welfare check. Right? It doesn't mean that somebody feels sorry for you. It doesn't mean that you've somehow failed in life. It means that you own something. And because you own something, you're entitled to receive as your share that payment.
As you were speaking, I just wrote down ownership. So exactly. You got to the concept of ownership, right? Is that this raises the who owns what. Yep. So the perspective on private versus public goods, right? If people in a country own the goods of that country, the resources of that country, it's a public good, as opposed to whoever maybe sits on top of it, whoever paid for those rights or the private ownership of it. So you're really getting into a broader notion here of private versus public goods and ownership.
Well, and a lot depends on what you think public means, because traditionally people who made those kinds of arguments that, for instance, the minerals belong to the people. The conclusion that they drew from that is that, therefore, the state should run the mining company, right? There was an argument for nationalization, that everything should be in the hands of the state, which is the classic argument for socialism. That has worked out horribly, right? We have seen what happens when you put all the economic power into the hands of the state. What you get is an overbearing, often totalitarian state. The experience in Africa with nationalization of major industries has been very poor. What interested me is that the arguments I was encountering in Namibia were not arguments for the state to take everything over. They were arguments for directly distributing some share of the wealth that's being produced to the citizenry via a small monthly payment. It doesn't sound like pie in the sky in Namibia because they have other grant programs that are already giving people small monthly payments for old age pensions, for instance, and child support grants and so on. So people are very familiar with the idea that the state might promise to pay you a certain amount of money every month and make good on that promise. So that's kind of opened up the door for imagining cash transfers as the vehicle for something much, much more far-reaching than that, which I think is an interesting moment.
And maybe changes maybe the concept of looking at these resources and the goods of a country or whatever it may be as a positive sum situation as opposed to a zero sum situation. Because if you look at, because I start listening to you talk about shares of something and I start thinking about shares of a pie, right? And a pie is finite.
Right.
And so there's only so much pie you can dole out. So that raises issues of zero-sum thinking and power distribution and who gets the most part of the pie. And then it goes back to those questions of ownership. But if you're looking at it in a different way in terms of sharing resources in a way that basically enlarges the pie and, you know, it's a positive-sum relationship, very different mindset, very different way in which you distribute things and can work against this power asymmetry, right? Is that what you're
suggesting? Right. And there are a couple of ways in which that can happen. That is, by improving the distribution system so that more people are getting pieces of the pie, one of the things you do is to create markets, right? People who have money can buy stuff. And if more of the population has money, then there are more people buying stuff. This is something that the Keynesian economics figured out a long time ago. Putting money into the hands of people who will spend it stimulates the economy. And so it's not a zero-sum game. You actually end up with greater economic growth, more opportunities to start businesses, this sort of thing. And you see that in the empirical work on cash transfers in South Africa. When social grants were introduced, townships started being sites where people could start up businesses. Why? Because your neighbors can buy stuff, right? People who were formerly just on the verge of destitution have a little bit of money. That means there's more opportunities to sell them things. The other way that it's more than zero sum is that a lot of very poor people are prevented from being economically active by their very poverty. That may be because they're sick and badly nourished and therefore not able to go out and become economically productive. It may be because they're kind of paralyzed spatially to travel around looking for work, to activating your social networks. All of that takes not a lot of money, but just a little bit of money in your pocket so that you can afford the transportation to get across town or to go out and visit those relatives or take care of your social obligations. So, in all of those ways, the difference between somebody with no money at all and somebody with just a little money is a big difference, even if it's quantitatively a small amount of money. And the research shows that people who have that little bit of money are often activated. They're enabled to be active socially and economically in a way that they wouldn't if they didn't have that little bit of money. And so again, you're getting more than just that amount of money expended. You're getting a bunch of social effects.
Right. So social, political, economic effects across the board, right? Because again, the distribution of this power, if you will, the distribution of resources across many prevents perhaps the abuse of power in the hands of a few. But yes. Before we finish today, because this has been such an interesting conversation, let's get to presence rather
than
membership. We have to talk about that. What do you mean by presence rather than membership?
The thing that I talked about in the book was about citizens claiming rights as citizens to a share. And that's a pretty well-defined set of relationships, right? We know who the members are. We know why it is they think they have a claim on something collective. It's because they're members of that collectivity. The wealth of Namibia should belong to Namibians. The thing that you immediately run into with that conception is the problem of the non-member, which is to say, in most countries today, there are a lot of people living in the country who are not citizens of that country. We find that in the United States. We find that in South Africa. We find it all over. And there are a whole bunch of questions then about, well, I understand we have certain social obligations toward our fellow citizens, but what social obligations should we have or do we have toward people who are not citizens and who are actually not supposed to be here at all? In South Africa, many, probably most of the poorest people, the people most in need of social assistance, are not South Africans. They're from Zimbabwe or Mozambique or something else. So how do we answer that question? And that I didn't really answer in the book, so I'm trying to do it with this new paper. The easy answer would be to say, well, they're owed nothing because they're not members and they're not supposed to be here. But in practice, that's not a very good answer, right? If you consider here in the United States and you say, okay, we've got these undocumented people living all around us. Should their kids be able to go to public school? Well, if you think of that as a question of rights, you would tend to say no. Right? They have no right to public schools. They're not citizens. They're not supposed to be here. But what if we don't let their kids go to school? Just practically, is that a good idea? For whom is it a good thing to have these kids here living among us but not going to school? Right? That, there are all kinds of ways in which that doesn't work out well for anybody. So on practical grounds, just about everywhere in the United States, children of undocumented people are allowed to go to public schools. Not because of a rights-based argument, but because it's a practical imperative of governing. Similar things happen around public health. If you've got a vaccination campaign, does it make sense to only allow the citizens to be vaccinated? Well, that's not how diseases work, right? Diseases don't care whether you're a citizen or not. You have to vaccinate at the level of the population. And the population is whoever's here, right? That is, its presence, not membership, that matters for some of these things. So I'm interested in the question of how do we think theoretically about this thing I'm calling presence. And it strikes me we've done a lot more theorizing about membership than we have about presence, which we've kind of taken as a common sense category. One of the things I'm trying to do is say, we can't do that. It's much too important. It's an increasingly prominent and I think in some ways promising basis for social claims, for arguments about social obligation. And there's a lot of thinking that's still to be done about what presence is and how we ought to understand it.
That kind of argument, though, do you think that the response to some might be, that's exactly why we want to work against presence, that it actually works to fuel the let's build walls, let's, you know, not let people in?
Oh, I think so. Argument. I think so. One of the things that the anti-immigrant sentiment picks up on is that once people are here among us, it's much harder to say no. It's much harder to pretend they're not human beings like we are. It's much harder to ignore the pressing claims that they have. I think that's one of the reasons why people are willing to take such risks to cross borders, is because they know how much stronger their claims will be once they get to the other side. At the same time, I think one of the things I'm trying to press us on is our understanding of what it means to be here in the first place. Why do some places count as here and other places don't? You know, if I'm living in Southern California, why do I think that Oklahoma is part of my here and that Tijuana isn't, right? Tijuana is much closer to me. It's actually culturally, in some ways, much more connected to me. But we have this taken-for-granted idea of what counts as here and what counts as there, who is really here among us and who isn't. And I think if we can make that all seem a little less self-evident and problematize our thinking about who counts as the people who are here and who doesn't, that will also change, that will argue against the significance of the border and open us up to other ways in which people are, in fact, present.
All right, Jim. Well, thank you so much for that fascinating conversation. Appreciate you being here today.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to my conversation with James Ferguson. He's an anthropologist at Stanford University. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Jacob McClellan edited this interview, and Sam Dupre produced the show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Rolotte.